Our first reading this morning is from the Christian Scriptures, chapter 2 of the book of John. 2 days later, there was a wedding in the town of Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited. When the wine had given out, Jesus' mother said to him, "They are out of wine." "You must not tell me what to do," Jesus replied. "My time has not yet come." Jesus' mother then told the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." The Jews have rules about ritual washing, and for this purpose, 6 stone water jars were there, each one large enough to hold between 20 and 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill these jars with water." They filled them to the brim, and then he told them, "Now draw some water out and take it to the steward in charge of the feast." They took him the water, which had now turned into wine, and he tasted it. He did not know where this wine had come from, but of course the servants who had drawn out the water knew. So he called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone else serves the best wine first, and after the guests have had a lot, he serves the ordinary wine. But you have kept the best wine until now." Our modern reading is by John Shelby Spong. Bishop Spong is a liberal Christian theologian, religion commentator, and prolific author. He is retired from the Episcopal Diocese of Newark, New Jersey, where he served as bishop for 21 years. He has been a guest speaker at our own UUA General Assembly on several occasions. In an interview, he said, "The oral tradition is the only way that the stories of Jesus could have lived between his death in 30 CE, approximately, and the writing of the Gospels between 70 CE and 100 CE. This means that everything we know about Jesus lived for 40 to 70 years in oral transmission before it was written down. The real questions are, where was this tradition preserved, by whom, and in what context? It was in the synagogue that the oral tradition was born, and in the synagogue that it thrived. Most of the gospel stories existed first as sermons preached about Jesus against the background of the synagogue readings of the Torah and the prophets. In this process, Jesus in the oral tradition came to be understood as the fulfillment of both the expectations of the Torah and the hopes of the prophets. The stories of Jesus appropriate to the great feasts and fasts of the Jewish year were developed in the oral tradition that enabled the Gospels to suggest that not only was the crucifixion of Jesus to be interpreted against the Passover, but also that every other major Jewish holy day was in time given Christian context by the oral tradition during the synagogue phase of Christian history."
So each of the 2 years that I've been with you, we have designated February as a focus month here at First Unitarian. And this hopefully provides us an opportunity to look deeply at a particular theme over the course of several weeks. And I always encourage various groups within the church to explore the significance of the theme to the work and the being of the different groups. Your own Prudential Committee met this past Tuesday evening and began a process of discerning the development of the developing story of your church in this transition from what has been to what will yet be. A story that will have a very significant page, not so far from now, that you'll begin. Having a focus month gives us all an extended opportunity to recognize and to own who we are in relationship to that theme. My hope is that we are a community of story will provide an entree into narrative story as a primary religious vehicle for finding and making meaning for the experiences of our lives, as well as by providing a roadmap into the world of our aspirations. And so today we begin with once upon a time, or maybe you like to start stories with long ago and far away. My hope is that through this exploration of narrative, we can begin to see its potential for engendering faith and hope in the future. Heaven knows that we can all use that. We all need faith and hope in the future of our lives, the future of this church community, the future of our country and of our world. Before placing it in its religious context, which may be an impossibility altogether because perhaps all story is religious in nature, let's look at the idea of narrative itself. Alan Moore, who wrote what? Anybody know what Alan Moore wrote? V is for Vendetta. Alan Moore wrote, "Artists use lies to tell the truth. Yes, I created a lie," he said, "but because you believed it, you found something true about yourself." Mythologist Robert A. Johnson, whom I'm a big fan of, puts it this way: myths are stories that aren't necessarily true on the outside, but reveal deep truths on the inside. When we attempt to touch on a deep truth that we experience in our lives, to comprehend or to express it, if we were to name it, the name we might give it, though, could too easily fail to incorporate the intricacies and the nuances that give our truth its significance. Names are important. The narrative, though, provides all sorts of ways to gain proximity to the truth with which we are attempting to relate. For example, the word parenthood or parenting. I might utter the sentence, "Parenting is an ultimate experience in the course of a human lifetime." And we all know something about parenting, whether we have been a parent or not. We've all been parented by someone, and some of us have actually committed that act itself. But because our experiences related to parenting vary so greatly, my sentence really doesn't invite anyone into much of a truth about it, regardless of my claim to its ultimacy. If, though, I were to tell you a story about parenting, I'm guessing you'd have better access to the human truth that I'm trying to explore here with you. In the wake of her death last week, I've spent a lot of time thinking about Mary Tyler Moore over the last few days. I have always been a very big fan of hers. In her award-winning movie, Ordinary People, do people remember Ordinary People? You might remember that she played the mother of a child who was drowned in an accident. The story of a mother who has lost a child invites us all, whether we've had that experience or not, into a place of knowing or at least understanding something of the human condition that comes about through such a devastating loss. It touches a deep, deep part in each of us, and the story lets us into that experience. I'm not altogether sure that there's any such thing as a non-religious story, but let's move into the realm of what might more widely be accepted as religious narrative. If I were to simply use the word God, it would mean so many different things to so many different people. What I mean by the word God, when I choose to use it, is something akin to a placeholder. It's a metaphor for that essence or energy that cannot be directly known. By the word God, I mean that mystery, which is at the core and the periphery of our being, of being itself. I'm guessing few of you would have that same understanding in response to the word God. But if I were to tell you a story about God, that mystery, maybe not even mentioning the word God, I'm guessing that most, if not all of you, would be able to grasp something of the essence of what I was trying to convey. I'd bet that you might be able to recognize your relationship with the truth of it or your relationship with the lack of truth in it. So let's take the story of the wedding at Cana from our reading that Kelly did a few minutes ago. This is one of my favorite biblical stories that I love to share at marriage ceremonies. Jesus and Mary attend a wedding. All of a sudden, there's this terrible wine shortage. Mary presses Jesus into service, and he begins to wine himself. Perhaps that's a better metaphor for a story on parenting. I don't know. But then Jesus complies with his mother's wish, and jugs of water are brought forward, a ladle of water is drawn out, and from it the steward tastes the best vintage of wine ever. Ta-da! The thing is, though, it's not ta-da. And that's the point. It's much deeper than ta-da. There is a miracle here for sure. But the miracle is not that Jesus is a grand magician who can or even would want to change the nature of anything to become something else. The elements of the story tell us that something else is going on here. What Jesus directed the steward to do, what he directed that bride and groom in the story to do, what he has directed through the story to every person who would ever get married, what Jesus, through the narrative of the story, is directing us all to do is to pay attention, to be very careful attention to the very ordinary nature of something as basic and simple as water. Look into the very ordinary and in it find the extraordinary, the extraordinary. Find that which is filled with grace and beauty and fulfillment. The character of Jesus through this narrative tells us to pay attention to our very ordinary day-to-day lives, for in each of us and in each of our days, there exists the extraordinary, that which can provide us and waits to provide us, I think, with grace and beauty and fulfillment if we pay attention to it and if we are open to it. The story of the wedding at Cana doesn't just throw the word God at us to see if it sticks. It offers us a way of deepening our experience with the potential for finding and making meaning in our lives. It offers us the potential for making more of ourselves and of this time that we have of being alive here on this planet Earth. I'm a very big fan of Bishop Jack Spong's. He's a theologian of significant renown within the structures of Christian orthodoxy. His understandings of the Gospels, as he expresses in his book, Liberating the Gospels, Reading the Bible with Jewish Eyes, are not just similar to how we're using religious narrative here this morning. He's talking about the exact same thing. Where did the Gospels come from? Jack Spong explains that they were created by the rabbis in the synagogues during that 40 to 70 year period after Jesus died. Did he do that? Were those creations made to fool the people who were attending the synagogues during that time? No, Jack Spong answers. It was in order to create narrative that would help to make the deeper meanings of the Torah accessible to the people through these stories that held relevance and contemporary significance for them. It was no different in many ways to the apocryphal stories that we tell about George Washington and Abraham Lincoln, about Mahatma Gandhi or Martin Luther King Jr. or Mother Teresa or any of the other saints who inspire us by their lives and by their character to go deep so that we might rise high. Jack Spong says, true religion is not about possessing the truth. No religion does that. Is that refreshing? It is, he said, rather an invitation into a journey that leads one toward the mystery of God. Idolatry is religion pretending that it has all the answers. God is not a Christian, God is not a Jew, God is not a Muslim or a Hindu or a Buddhist. All of these are human systems which human beings have created to try to help us walk into the mystery of God, he writes. I honor my tradition, says Jack Spong. I honor my tradition, I walk through my tradition, but I don't think my tradition defines God. I think it only points me towards God. Fill in your own word here where he uses God. If God works, that's fine. But we are here to go deep, to go as deeply as we can into the mystery so that we might drink out the very marrow of life as fully as we are capable. We are a community of story because it is through story and the proximity that it provides us, the access it provides us to truth and meaning. The word religion comes from Latin roots meaning to bind, as in to bind in community. The earliest religious experiences for our human ancestors occurred when the people of the clan or the tribe gathered around the communal fire to tell stories, to help them find and make meaning in their lives. From the grasslands of Africa to the prairies of North America, from the Andean mountains of South America to the banks of the fjords in Scandinavia, people gathered and they created and told stories about themselves and about their gods. That didn't mean that there weren't gods. It meant that gods could not be known. It meant that any understandings of that which is mystery might be made available through the use of story. I'm not suggesting that we pitch history and science or math and music or any of the disciplines overboard. I realized I was talking to so many faculty members here this morning when I wrote that. We're not talking about throwing the disciplines overboard. Facts are important to us, however short-lived they might be. Facts are about things, but things are the stuff upon which we stretch the canvas of our lives. What we are talking about this morning is not so much things as it is the meaning of things. In truth, I think our various disciplines of study are really so many languages, so many approaches that we have of telling ourselves and each other stories that help us to understand this human experience, that help us to find and make meaning in it. I suspect that we join together in community, in religious community, and most specifically in the First Unitarian Church religious community, in order to share stories and in order to be a part of the story. A story about transformation, the transformation of our hearts, our homes, our community, and our world. Stories are a bridge leading us from the past through the present towards a hope-filled future. The past is filled with stories of challenge and struggle, even devastation. But also, the past is filled with stories of resurrection and redemption. Each of our own personal stories and our corporate shared stories is similarly filled with challenge and struggle and devastation. But each of them is likewise filled with resurrection and redemption. We are not only players in our stories, but we can choose to be the authors, or at least the co-authors of them. So what are the stories you would choose? What are the stories that you want to learn from? What are the stories that you want to be a part of? What are the stories in which you are or want to be the narrator of the story? Being grown up, being a religiously intentional person, is about taking responsibility for our stories. Taking responsibility for being in them and how we are in them. This congregation will soon be calling your new minister to come and walk and to work and to be with you. What is the 300-year-old story of this congregation that compels you to turn its next page in faith and hope and in love? I can tell you the story that I've seen lived out here in my short time, in the 18 months that I've been with you. It's a story of spirit and devotion and service. It's a story of commitment and daring. Perhaps you'll recognize yourself in this story. It's a story of vision that encourages you to put together the pieces that are required to provide an organized structure in which members of this congregation are cared for. It's a story of commitment to standing on the side of justice and love, standing up against injustice and making justice for those in the larger community who, because of race or class, gender, sexuality, or gender identity, have been marginalized. It's a story of learning to be fiscally responsible in your relationship to the past of this congregation and to the promise of its future. It's a story about learning to communicate in effective ways where truth can be spoken and heard, where information can be given and received. You have an incredible story here that you bring to this moment of threshold in the unfolding life of this congregation. You have every reason for faith, every reason for hope, every reason to share love in and for the future that is yours here at First Unitarian. I would be remiss in this moment of angst and anger and fear if I were to fail to relate our theme to the emerging narrative of our national story. What stories ought we be paying attention to in this moment? I think it would be wise for us to remember the stories of fascist Nazi Germany. I think it would be wise to recall our own national stories of Japanese American internment camps here in the U.S. during that same war period. I think it would be good for us to remember stories in which human fear gave birth to the very basest of human instincts. Why should we remember these stories? Surely not so that we might repeat them, but so that we can learn from them that in the end, love does triumph over hate, and faith triumphs over fear. There were many in Nazi Germany, including our own Unitarians, Waitzel and Martha Sharp, who risked life and limb to defend and protect the Jews and the homosexuals and the gypsies who were being exterminated by the Third Reich. Perhaps some of you saw the movie about Sharp's War, about Martha and Waitzel Sharp, a movie that was produced by Ken Burns and that aired on PBS this past October. There were many in this country also who protested the imprisonment of Japanese Americans who were guilty of nothing more than their genetic heritage, perhaps similar to what's beginning to happen to some of our Arab neighbors. In the days to come, we will need the support of stories of resistance and persistence, of service and of love and of justice. We will need to remember stories of challenge and struggle and even devastation, so that we might help to write the next chapters of this American story, so that we will be sure to include in them the possibilities of resurrection and redemption. Those are the stories that are waiting for us to write them today. We are a community of story, once upon a time, long ago and far away. These are always about the here and the now. The sharing of stories is an age-old practice in the tradition of religion. Stories are a way of telling the truth that lives within. Stories tell us each to pay attention to our very ordinary day-to-day lives, for in each of us and in all of our days, there does exist the extraordinary, that which can provide us and waits to provide us grace and beauty and fulfillment, if we pay attention and if we are open to them. May it be so. Amen.